frog.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Zoran Dragutinovich. I represent the counter plaintiff appellant Chicago Conservation Center in this matter. It's a counterclaim for defamation per se against the counter defendant Patrick King. For nearly the last 20 years, my client, the Conservation Center, has been providing conservation and restoration services with respect to all types of fine arts, from sculptures to watercolors and large murals and public buildings. During that time, the center has endeavored to build a reputation as a top-of-the-line, full-service facility providing conservation services to art owners, galleries, museums, and governmental agencies. As in most businesses, particularly in a small but competitive business community such as art conservation, a good reputation is an essential component of success in the business. If the lack of lawsuits is any indication of success in this endeavor, prior to the incident that gave rise to this lawsuit, the Conservation Center was not involved in any lawsuits. In July of 1998, there was a fire in the home in Glencoe, Bruce and Dale Fry. The Conservation Center was asked to and did pick up some 300 plus pieces of art and transport them to its Chicago facility for evaluation and possible restoration. But because the art was inventoried and examined, but because the Chicago Conservation Center was not authorized to perform any treatment services, it didn't do so. The art remained at the Conservation Center for approximately 2 weeks, after which, at the request of the owner, it was transported to another location. At that other location, in September of 1998, some 7 weeks after it had left the Conservation Center, the art was examined by counter-defendant Patrick King, who had been hired by the art owner as his consultant with respect to the fire loss. Mr. King examined some, among other things, some 83 pieces of two-dimensional art, oil paintings, acrylics, watercolors, lithographs, and the like, many of them framed behind glass. At that time, Mr. King told the owner of the art, and this was testified to at trial in the district court by the art owner, that the art had faded because it was subjected to ozone at the center.
Now that was on what date?
That was on, it's unclear whether he said it on August 28th or it's as early as August 28th, 1998 or as late as September 9th, 1998.
Well, what did your complaint say?
I'm sorry?
What did you say when you made your allegation?
In the complaint?
Did you specify a date? Yeah.
Yes, we stated that on or about September 9th, this statement was made. And not in the exact words that were testified to a trial, but certainly in substance, it was pretty much the same statement.
The art had the art been moved from your facility by the 28th, or was it still at your facility?
Oh, no. It was removed from our facility on the 23rd of July, which was, as I indicated, 6 to 7 weeks before it was examined.
In your view, does it really make a difference as to whether or not Mr. Kane saw this work on the 28th of August or not?
Well, it really doesn't, because whether it's 6 weeks, 7 weeks, or even 5 weeks, it doesn't matter, because the gist of our allegation was that there was no way he could tell any objective means that this art had in fact been subjected to ozone, other than someone actually seeing that it had happened. There was no such evidence. The only evidence was Mr. King said he could smell ozone or decaying ozone emanating from the art. There was testimony at trial from Professor Steven Spivak of the University of Maryland, who's worked with ozone. He's one of the few researchers doing primary research with ozone as a deodorizer, who testified that the chemistry of ozone renders Mr. King's assertion that he could smell ozone as an impossibility. There's no way you can smell ozone 6 or 7 weeks after the fact.
Well, he had repeated, however, if he had recognized the smell in August, and had informed Mr. Fry at that time but yet went ahead and repeated the statement on September 9th, it would seem to me you'd have a better case as to question of his intent. You'd also have a better case with respect to whether this was a statement of fact as opposed to a statement of opinion. But you're not making that argument.
No, we're not. The fact of the matter is he made the statement, whether he made it once or twice. The district court dismissed, at the conclusion of the trial, the district court dismissed the counterclaim on the grounds, on the specific grounds that the statement was one of opinion and not fact, and therefore was not actionable as defamation.
Even if we accept it's an opinion of fact, or just statement of fact, does it really become libel per se, defamation per se, in this circumstance? That after all, it would simply be, at best, a misstatement with respect to one instance. Does that really harm you or your client's reputation as that is contemplated when we talk about defamation per se?
We believe it does, and we believe that...
The case law to back that up in the state of Illinois?
Well, certainly. In Costello versus Capital Cities Communication, the Illinois, and we cite that in our brief, the Illinois Supreme Court rejected the notion that a defamatory statement about a single instance was insulated from liability under the innocent construction rule because the defamatory effect was simply not strong enough. The court indicated that the totality of the circumstances and the context of the statement are to be examined to determine its defamatory effect. And in this case, we're talking about a statement that some 83 individual pieces of art had been caused to fade because of exposures to ozone. That's a large number of works that are alleged to have been damaged. And for a business such as the Conservation Center, which prides itself in the quality of the service that it provides, to have an instance where 83 valuable pieces of art are alleged to have been faded is, we believe, damaging to its reputation.
I guess you would also have the argument that action would have been taken without the authorization of the owner. The owner apparently gave no authorization for any work to be done.
That's correct. In fact, no work was done. There was no evidence that any work was done other than Mr. King's statement that he could smell ozone, which Professor Spivak declared to be scientifically impossible. You cannot smell ozone 7 weeks after the fact. The half-life of ozone lasts anywhere from 5 minutes to 30 minutes, so that in a room in which there's an ozone generator, within 12 hours, there is absolutely no, the ozone level in a room is no more than it is in atmospheric oxygen. You just cannot smell it. To the extent that Mr. King has stated that what he was really smelling, the so-called bleachy smell that he could smell on every piece of art, was the byproduct of the interaction between the ozone and whatever was on the paintings, that also was declared to be scientifically improbable, if not impossible, because of the thousands and thousands upon...
Who was present on the night when the statement was made?
Mr. Fry. Mr. Fry, who was the owner of the art, was present at a minimum. And that is the basis of our claim, is that he told the art owner that his art was
anyone else present?
The evidence, there was no evidence that anyone else was present at the time. Now that of course raises the issue of whether Mr. King was privileged in making the statement that he did, and we believe that, and we can see that there was a qualified privilege to give such a statement, but we believe that privilege has been abused by Mr. King, and there's certainly ample evidence in the record to show that he did that. Mr. King admitted he had no personal knowledge of how or when the center uses ozone in its business.
Given the relationship between Mr. King and Mr. Fry, is it really fair to say that was a statement of fact as opposed to a statement of opinion? Mr. King, as I understand it, was really a consultant to Mr. Fry, trying to advise him as what he ought to do with his artwork. Am I right?
That's correct.
And the understanding between these two gentlemen must have been that Mr. King didn't see the ozone applied, wasn't present when the ozone applied. He was giving a rendition of an opinion as to what he thought probably happened, right?
That's correct, but regardless of what his status was, whether he was called upon to give an opinion or what, it was a statement of fact. You look at what he said, and there are actually, in his statement, there are three... The test in Illinois to determine whether a statement is one of fact or opinion is if it can be objectively verified. If it can be objectively verified, it's a statement of fact. Here, you have actually three objectively verifiable facts in that statement. And those facts are, one, the art faded. Two, it faded because it was subjected to ozone. And three, it was subjected to ozone at the center. Each one of these raises a question. Either the art faded or it didn't. That can be answered, yes or no. Did it or didn't it? Did it fade because it was subjected to ozone? That's another question that can be objectively verified. As is the last one, was it exposed to ozone at the conservation center? So there are really three factual statements in that. This isn't even a statement of opinion which implies undisclosed defamatory facts. These facts are simply
I understand defamatory. That, you know, in the last decade, Illinois law certainly has struck a different balance on the fact-opinion dichotomy than it did previously. It's taken its hint from the Supreme Court, and it's realized that more things are now considered statements of fact or can be considered statements of fact than they could. But has Illinois ever gone this far where, I mean, doesn't Illinois also say you have to take the statement in context, the context of the whole transaction around it? Has Illinois really ever gone this far as to say that somebody who's in an advisory capacity to the principal and makes a statement like this is really rendering a statement of fact, one that should be understood as a statement of fact as opposed to a statement of opinion? I mean, this was the thing that bothered the district judge, as I understand the transcript.
It certainly did, but again, I come back to the Illinois law, certainly, and the law in other jurisdictions certainly provides for the abuse of a qualified privilege.
But
here, Mr. King.
But we're talking about fact or opinion. I haven't gotten a privilege yet. Okay? Why is this? What's your closest case in Illinois for saying this is a statement of fact as opposed to a statement of opinion?
I think in context, Judge, I can point to any number of cases that deal with statements of fact and statements of opinion. This is certainly, in my view, a very clear statement of fact. I mean, there's...
But you see, our problem is in the view of the district judge, it was a clear statement of opinion. And we've got that in front of us. And I'm just trying to figure out if, you know, what case... We have to look at the cases around this... to guide us in deciding whether you're right or she's right. Can you help me out there?
We've certainly cited cases in our brief that do discuss the difference between fact and opinion. There's and I can start digging in my brief right now.
No, I don't.
But it's in there, and certainly, again, it comes the more restrictive test applied by Illinois prior to Bryson, which expanded the definition, the issue is it objectively verifiable? Here you have three elements to his statement that are objectively verifiable.
You're eating well and
yes, I am, and I would like to conclude now and have an opportunity to respond. To
very good. Okay. All right. Ms. Rosenthal.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, first I'd like to start off in just saying that there was an error that the plaintiff's counsel keeps bringing up throughout his brief, and he's touched upon it in his argument. I just want to make it clear that the district court ruled that this was an opinion and therefore not defamation per se. The analysis with respect to qualified privilege is only relevant to comments that are considered to be defamation per se. Therefore, when the when the plaintiff says that the judge improperly removed the consideration of the question of whether King abused the qualified privilege, that is mistaken. That is not the law. The law is that if this court or the district court, the lower court, decided that the comment is not defamation per se, then there's absolutely no need to go through the qualified privilege analysis or any abuse thereof.
Well, let's take a look at that fact opinion issue then. Why are you maintaining at this point in the litigation that this was a statement of opinion?
Yes, I am, sir.
Okay, what is the best authority in Illinois from your perspective?
Well, there's the Wilco versus Forbes case. In that case, the court stated that if it is plain that the speaker is expressing a subjective view, an interpretation, a theory, conjecture, or surmise, rather than claiming to be in possession of objectively verifiable facts, then the statement is not actionable per se. It's clear that in this situation, this comment was clearly plain to Bruce Rye that that was a conjecture, a theory. And how do we know that? First of all, Bruce Rye himself admits that he knows that Patrick King's statement is only an opinion. And the transcript of 91701 at 9, Supplemental Record 6. When asked this question, Bruce Rye, page 1516, in that letter you state, we have clear proof that ozone, which is a tool commonly used by the Chicago Conservation Center in performing examinations, was used. Do you see that? Bruce Rye answers yes. Question, what was your clear proof? Answer, it was an opinion. It had to be an opinion from my expert. Bruce Rye knew that Patrick King wasn't holding on to facts that he wasn't aware of. And you can tell that also by the context of how this occurred. Bruce Rye hired Patrick King in July of 1998, shortly after the fire, July 13th of 1998. Patrick King knew that Bruce Rye had taken the art or sent the art to Chicago Conservation Center. Patrick King didn't say at that point, oh, they exposed the art to ozone. No. It wasn't until they saw the art together and it was unwrapped on August 28th at Pickens Kane. And Bruce Fry was the first one who said, my art faded. Look at my art. What happened to my art? What's that chemical smell? In response to that, Patrick King also looked at the art, and he had seen the art on two prior occasions prior to the fire and noticed, yeah, it does look faded. And then Patrick King, also they noticed there was no smoke on the paintings, which when they were taken from the Bruce Rye home, there was smoke and soot. Now they were clean. And Patrick King said, I smell this bleachy smell, which is familiar to me from somebody being exposed to ozone, because Pat King was familiar with that smell from using it in his business.
Ms. Rosa, perhaps I misunderstood opposing counsel. I was led to believe, or at least that's what I read, that no work was done on these paintings.
Well, according to Barry Bauman of Chicago Conservation Center, they say that no work was done.
So how at the time that Mr. King and Mr. Fry examined it, was it free of the at least preliminary cleaning? Somebody did some preliminary cleaning after the fire, I assume.
Well,
is it not clear who did that?
That's correct, Your Honor, because when the testimony was is when the paintings left the Bruce Fry household after the fire, they were filled with smoke and soot, and they went over to Chicago Conservation Center, where, according to them, they didn't do any work. Then it was shipped over to Pickens Kane, and it was in Pickens Kane for about a month before Bruce Rye and Patrick King saw it, Patrick King seeing it for the first time after the fire. It was at that point that Bruce Rye noticed all these differences. No smoke, no soot on the frame. It looked faded. So at that point is when the conjecture or surmise came up, well, maybe it was exposed to ozone, is what Pat King's testimony was. And it came out later that between the time of August 28th, when they saw the artwork, Patrick King still invited the Chicago Conservation Center to Pickens Kane in order to evaluate the artwork and do a proposal along with other conservators.
Why was there, I'm
Please, go ahead.
What was the reasoning behind the transfer from, if it was already lodged at a restoration house, why did it go to a storage facility with the possibility of a return? Maybe it's just an insignificant matter, but it just it intrigues me.
Okay. The reason why that happened was because when it went to Chicago Conservation Center, Bruce Fry had not determined who all was going to do the work on all those pieces. So he wanted to have estimates from more people than just Chicago Conservation Center. It was removed immediately by Chicago Conservation Center to protect the art and take it away from the house, which was open, and, you know, which was
so
their requirement.
Mr. Fry called, not a storage facility per se, but a restoration house to remove it with what, the consideration that they might be a potential restorer rather than the restorer?
There was a confusion, and there was a lot of testimony that was at respect at the trial, whether they were hired to just remove it and store it or whether they were hired to actually do the restoration, because it was happened so fast. They were recommended by the restoration company who was cleaning out the house, and they said, we can't handle this art. Here's a name, Chicago Conservation Center. So they came right away, took all the art away. And then when Mr. Fry hired Mr. King, Mr. King said, well, the insurance company usually likes to have two or three estimates. So they asked Barry Bauman at Chicago Conservation Center if other people could come to the facility at Chicago Conservation Center to evaluate the art. And he said no, he didn't want any people in his facility, and that's why it was then transferred to Pickens Kane, and they were still invited to come to do the proposal to restore the art. However, after August 28th, when Patrick King called back the Chicago Conservation Center to tell them when the viewing at Pickens Kane would occur, Heather Becker said, oh, we've already done that. We've already done the proposal. So there you go. There you have this. And Patrick King asked, well, who gave you the permission to do the proposal? And she said, the insurance company. So that's what happened.
Ms. Rosenthal, I'm sorry, but I did not get the name of the case you cited originally on the opinion fact question.
Wilco versus Forbes, 241 F3rd 552.
Did you cite that in your brief?
Yes, I did, Judge.
I see. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And just to close up on the fact that, well, our argument that this is an opinion, is that you do have to look at the totality of the circumstances, as Your Honor was saying before. And the Wilco case states that, and so does the Milkovich case. And you have to look at the context of the statement. And in the context of the statement, the plaintiff's attorney keeps quoting the first two questions, citing the first two questions on the stand to Mr. Fry. But later in Mr. Fry's testimony, and I urge you to relook at it, it is clear that Mr. Fry is basically stating that King never said that that the center had ozone the work. And I point you to Bruce Fry 9 and 10. When he was asked, Bruce Fry was asked, did he say where any ozoning had been done? Answer, I don't recall. Now he goes on to say, but you stated to Mr. Bauman that it was done at the Chicago Conservation Center. That is correct. Answer, that's what Mr. King said to me, yes. Now, if you read this in context, you will see that it really refers to Chicago Conservation Center does ozone items, but he never said that they did it in this instance, because later again, plaintiff's counsel asked Bruce Fry again, did you have an understanding that in the facts and circumstances known to you at the time of the fire and after, that when Mr. King told you that the ark had been ozoned, the ozonation took place at the Chicago Conservation Center. Bruce Fry says, I don't really recall what I said or what we discussed in reference to that, other than it was ozone. I thought it was ozone, and it was ozone, and there was no smell to the art, and the art was faded. So it's clear that King never really said that the Chicago Conservation Center did it. It's just that he told them they had the capability of doing it. And therefore, that's really just his conjecture or surmise, and therefore is an opinion rather than a fact that he is trying to tell Bruce Fry that he knows about. And Bruce Fry understands that it's an opinion. And he's the only one that this allegedly defamatory comment was published to, and the person that it was published to himself understands that it's just an opinion, Joseph Stramat.
So your understanding is that on the at the time the opinion was, or the statement was made, no one else was present?
Exactly.
Thank you.
And that leads me to the next argument, that you, this court can affirm this decision on other grounds, as you know, and one of them is that this is not assailing the business methods of the Chicago Conservation Center. It's all throughout the trial that ozoning is not considered a bad practice in the industry. Pat King tells that to Bruce Fry. Bruce Fry testifies to it on the stand by saying he knows that ozoning isn't considered a bad thing, but it's not as if in this situation Pat King stated something like, oh, they threw acid on your painting, which would be understood to be a bad thing as far as Bruce Fry was concerned.
Of course, it was it would have been unauthorized in their view as well, right? Since it had the apparently no permission had been given to do anything with the paintings.
Well, it would have been unauthorized at that point to have done that, but still, the situation is that it might have been unauthorized, but you know, you can, if you buy the other argument that they had permission from the insurance company, whose authority did they have,
well,
and is that so?
You know, we can't resolve that summary judgment.
Okay, but essentially, still, the use of ozone is not considered a bad practice. And once again, I go back to the fact that it's a theory, and they didn't say that they lacked integrity in any such way. That leads me to my next statement that can be innocently construed, as Your Honor was talking about before, is that you have to look at the reputational damage and how seriously was the reputation of the Chicago Conservation damaged in this situation. Because the case is held that it's still not defamatory per se, even if the statement does assail the business method, if there's no serious reputational damage that can be had, because defamation per se is a very strong instrument. And it assumes that their reputation is damaged. In this case, the only publication was to Bruce Fry, and that's it. It wasn't like Patrick King posted it on a board and shouted it to the rooftop.
Ms. Rosenthal, if we were to get beyond that issue and had to look at the question of privilege, isn't there a genuine issue of tribal fact on the issue of privilege?
Well, Your Honor, if this court determines that the statement was not defamatory per se,
I understand. We have all those steps to go through first.
Okay, right. Would it be a question for the jury? Well, that leads me to my last argument, which is that ordinarily it would be a question for the jury to see whether the abuse of the qualified privilege has occurred. However, according to the Dark case, the Dark case that I cited in my brief, this court can affirm this decision even if you hold that it's defamatory per se, if no reasonable jury could come to any other conclusion that there was an abuse of the qualified privilege. In other words, if no jury could find that there was an abuse of a qualified privilege, then you could still affirm the decision based on that. And in this situation, there was no abuse of a qualified privilege because they tried to talk about this prior incident involving Robert O'Connell and another man's art that happened, I cited in my brief, 6 months beforehand, but it's really a year and a half. We just counted the year wrong, a year and a half prior. That instance has nothing to do with the statement that was made to Bruce Fry in August of 1998. And so, according to the case that I cited in my brief, too, that should be disregarded. And Patrick King did investigate this. He didn't make a statement with any reckless disregard for the truth. He stated that he noticed that it was faded. Bruce Fry said that the art was faded. Patrick King had a history of using ozone in his own business, so he knows that familiar smell that could occur, which smelled like bleach. He didn't say anything until he smelled the bleach, he saw that it had faded, and he noticed that there was no smoke smell. All of those things are side effects of ozoning, which Patrick King had noticed from his own use of ozone.
Did Mr. Fry ever say that he also apprehended the odor?
Yes, he said, "What's that chemical smell?" Before Patrick King said anything. He also said, before Patrick King said anything, Mr. Fry said, "What happened to my art? It's faded."
That's in dispute, though, isn't it?
No.
That statement's not in dispute?
No.
Thank you, Ms. Rosenthal.
Thank you, Judge.
Ms. Rodunovich?
Thank you. Just a couple of things that I'd like to touch on. again, there was no evidence here that the Chicago Conservation Center did any treatment work or any work of any kind, whether it's ozoning, cleaning, or anything, any of this art. What Mr. Fry might have seen with respect to soot and so forth could have been simply from handling. Dr. Spivak also testified that the smoke smell could have simply dissipated by itself after a period of a month or so of exposure to atmospheric air. And the only evidence that anything was done to this art is Mr. King's assertion that this was ozone.
Is this any more than a statement by Mr. King that the CCC wasn't careful in maintaining the art in its possession?
This is much more so. It implies that there was an unauthorized treatment of art that actually ruined it. In fact, Mr. King, you know, Mr. Fry clearly testified that he was told that the art was faded because it had been exposed to ozone at the center.
I appreciate that. But if Mr. Fry said, "My art has faded," to Mr. King, and Mr. King said, "Well, those who were handling it didn't handle it very well," didn't get into the specifics of ozone, making a comment that the Conservation House did not possess it in the appropriate fashion, is that defamatory? And isn't that the...
Unless he has some other way of determining that...
Well, he's a restoration expert, right?
He holds himself out as a restoration but that's questionable.
I didn't mean to make a finding on that. I'm just suggesting. I'm trying to see, on this opinion fact thing, how much different it is than my hypothetical of Mr. King, just looking at it and saying, well, whoever's possessed this since the fire hasn't done a good job. That may
shade over into the opinion area, but here a specific reason is given, and we believe there's ample fact in the record to show that he had no basis to make that statement.
Basis because of his lack of capacity as a person who could make the assessment?
Because what he said, his ability to smell ozone is scientifically impossible. He had no corroborative evidence.
I appreciate that argument. I'm just saying in his capacity of that slightly above a layman, since he deals in the art world, I'm assuming this, whether or not his expertise is what you would argue it is not. Has he done anything more than say this has not been handled well?
We believe he did. He gave a specific reason, one that Mr. Fry then turned around and in a letter to insurance company said he had clear proof that ozone was used. Clear proof is more than a mere opinion.
Thank you to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the